It's the 5th of April, 2024, and this is the Room Now podcast. Hi, I'm Dr. Jack Cush, executive editor of RoomNow.com. This week, we're going to discuss pain and why it's such a pain. We're probably not as good as we think we are at managing pain, especially when we think we've controlled the disease. Pain continues to be there. It's got many faces. There was this old commercial a long time ago, "I've fallen and I can't get up." I think that's the mantra of those on opioids. And we're going to talk about Dupuytren's contractures and imaging and polymyalgia rheumatica and more. So let's begin with this, "I've fallen and I can't get up." JAMA had an interesting article this week about a large national cohort of people who received opioids, 3.2 million people. And they looked at the association between opioid use and falls. And the numbers were kind of striking. So 3.2 million, there were over 500,000 serious falls, which was even worse when you consider that there was 5,200, I think, deaths from falls. That makes the risk of a serious fall with an opioid prescription to be 1 in 6. And the risk of death from falls when taking opioids be 1 in 600. Now, I would have guessed actually even more rare as far as dying from a fall. But basically, the report shows you that falls are a serious problem, that falls increase with age. The greatest age group or the greatest group that was at risk here were those 85, where the adjusted incidence rate ratio was sixfold higher compared to an 18 to 40 age group. By the way, why are over 85-year-olds getting opioids? You know, I'm sure that they're needed for surgery and whatnot, but obviously this report says you need to be more cautious in this group or have a high concern and try to protect the patient. The other important factor here is that the risk of falls with opioid use is really highest in the first 28 days of their use. So those are things to live by. You may have seen the SURPASS study that was published in Arthritis and Rheumatology this week. These are all the big-time spondylitis researchers who were authors on this head-to-head study of secukinumab versus an adalimumab biosimilar made by Sandoz. And it was given to people with axial SpA. And the primary endpoint was X-ray progression. Secondary endpoints were all about, you know, change from baseline in modified Stokes MSAS scores and SI inflammation and things like that. The bottom line on this study was that there was no difference between secukinumab and an adalimumab biosimilar. And it's 859 patients in this trial, and the endpoint was at 2 years, week 102. No significant difference. The primary endpoint, which was no X-ray change, no X-ray progression, and that was achieved by 2/3 of all three groups. There was two different doses of secukinumab and one dose of adalimumab, 150, 300, and 40 milligrams respectively. There was no difference in the change in MSAS scores, only about 0.5 to 0.7 units. All the other endpoints were the same, and clinical endpoints, including ASAS-20, ASAS-40, not different between the groups. So there's no superiority here. And I don't know what your feelings are about IL-17 inhibition compared to TNF inhibition in patients with spondylitis. Some believe that the TNF inhibitors are more effective. I don't know that I believe that. That's not been my experience. And I think that this really large study with really strong radiographic and clinical endpoints showed no difference between the two biologic targets, that being IL-17 or tumor necrosis factor. Will that change your prescribing? Dupuytren's contracture. What do you do? You know, at one point I was I was invited to learn how to use the collagenase injections into Dupuytren's contractor as a means of therapy, and the people who were marketing that were trying to convince thus rheumatologists who they wanted us to use it that this was as effective as surgery. And I didn't like the procedure. It looked a little bit barbaric, and there were videos of spurting blood and that sort of thing. But this was a Annals of Internal Medicine published this week, a randomized controlled trial that looked at patients with established Dupuytren's who were either treated with surgery, about 100 patients, needle fasciotomy, 100 patients, and collagenase injections, 100 patients. The endpoints were at 3 months and at 2 years. And the endpoint was 50% improvement in the contracture and, I guess, range of motion. And at 3 months, all three of these interventions were equal. Roughly about 71 to 73% of people met that endpoint of greater than 50% improvement. However, when those people were followed out to 2 years, only the surgery group maintained their improvement at 78%, whereas that same benchmark of improvement fell off to 50 and 65% in the fasciotomy and collagenase group, suggesting that in the long run, surgery still may be the better move. And, you know, if you talk to your hand surgeon colleagues, they still are probably recommending the surgery over those other two interventions. You may have seen the MMWR report that came out, I think this week or last, about the identification of strange fungal infections, coccidioidomycosis, histoplasmosis, and blastomycosis, between 2019 and 2021. They identified almost 60,000 in the United States, 60,000 cases of cocci, 3,600 of histo, and only 719 cases of blastomycosis. Again, these are going to be in endemic areas for the first two. Blasto being much more unusual. What's really unusual is that these case rates were identified during the pandemic. And they noted an unusually high fatality rate, especially with blastomycosis, of 17%, which is about two times the usual reported fatality rate. I bring this up, one, to remind you that patients who are on TNF inhibitors, more so than other biologics, are at risk for these strange fungal infections. And that in the early days of TNF inhibitor use, back in around 2003, 2004, the FDA put out a strong warning to physicians saying that you should be worried about these infections in people who have your diseases, who are taking TNF inhibitors, who have strange presentations, because what they were seeing at the FDA when they were reviewing these cases were high fatality rates. Fatality rates were related to these infections not being considered nor diagnosed, and hence a lot of the diagnoses were made on autopsy and after the patient died. So again, I want you to worry about these strange infections in patients on TNF inhibitors. And it's really the same as the TB story. Usually it happens after 6 months or so of exposure, it actually peaks around 6 months, but it can be as long as they're on the TNF inhibitor. It tends to be front-loaded, though, meaning it's in the first 6 months, first year. I like the study that looked at FDG PET scanning in patients with polymyalgia rheumatica. A cohort of 337 patients with polymyalgia rheumatica all underwent FDG PET, and they were followed for 6 months, and they found that overall 9% of patients, or 31 patients, had subclinical vasculitis identified by PET. I want to remind you that most of you who have taught about PMR and whatnot have used that slide that shows of all the people who have PMR, there's probably 10% who would be biopsy positive for GCA if you did a biopsy on a temporal artery biopsy, even if people didn't have symptoms. And then if you consider all the people with GCA, 50% have PMR symptoms. That's a well-known slide, and I think we've we've actually made that a download on Room Now. This data sort of goes along with that. Of those 31 patients who had subclinical vasculitis on PET, 21 were isolated large vessel, 3 were isolated cranial arteritis, and 7 were both. They found that steroid use was higher in the patients who did have subclinical vasculitis. However, relapse rates were not higher if you were on higher steroids or lower steroids. Anyway, I still am a firm believer of not doing imaging, whether that's ultrasound of temporal arteries in people with polymyalgia rheumatica, or doing crazy expensive investigations like this to find something that probably doesn't need to be treated. I think that you should let the symptomatology or refractoriness to therapy guide the way. That's my opinion. A study of 158 patients with active RA. These patients had, you know, I'd say moderate to sometimes high disease, -28s of 3.6 to 5.6, and pain scores of 4 to 7 out of 10. When they looked at these people and they evaluated them, including a clinical evaluation and also a ultrasound evaluation looking for a power Doppler signal to identify inflammation, they found of the 158, 27% had a positive power Doppler suggesting inflammation was behind their pain scores. That there was another 20% who had fibromyalgia, meaning they had negative power Doppler at a positive exam for fibromyalgia. There was 19% who had both fibromyalgia and inflammation. And there was 27% who had no fibromyalgia and no power Doppler abnormalities on ultrasound. What in the world? This is the kind of difficulty you have in people that you're managing, that the sources of pain in someone with rheumatoid arthritis, even when they're treated, even when they're controlled, can be multimodal and complex. And you've got to do a good exam. And you probably shouldn't be afraid to do something like ultrasound or further imaging if you feel it's necessary to focus in on what needs to be treated to manage their pain. Oral surveillance came out a few years ago, and it's still coming out. This is the oral surveillance study revisited, where they looked specifically at venous thromboembolic events in patients, especially over time. And they looked at two cohorts, the ones that were treated with the TNF inhibitors and those that were treated with either 10 or 5 milligrams BID of tofacitinib. And they did continue to show that patients on the tofacitinib were still having higher rates of venous peripheral venous thromboembolism like DVT or pulmonary emboli, and that was more events compared to those that were on TNF inhibitors. But the important part of this study is that the occurrence of these VTE events were consistent over time, meaning they just didn't happen in the beginning. They also underscored in this reanalysis the importance of other factors known to drive the risk of venous thromboembolic disease, and that would include increasing age, increasing BMI, a prior history of a VTE event, you're more likely to get it again, and then, as you know from other studies that we've talked about here, disease activity in RA increases the risk of getting, or inflammation overall increases the risk of having VTE events. A Korean claim study looked at pregnancy outcomes. This is using insurance claims data. A large number of patients, this is 5728 patients, of whom about 1 in 5 had adverse pregnancy outcomes. What they showed in this study is that the most commonly used DMARD in their population was hydroxychloroquine, and patients stayed on that throughout the pregnancy. That those that went into pregnancy on DMARD use decreased steadily over time. Interestingly, they did show people who were on methotrexate or leflunomide at conception or within 3 months of conception had a significantly higher rate of adverse pregnancy outcomes with about a twofold higher risk. Now, we probably talked about this in the past, but while methotrexate and leflunomide are obviously bad drugs for pregnancy, and they used to be a category X, and patients should not be on them when they're trying to conceive, there's a number of reports about patients who can even though they conceived on methotrexate leflunomide, that they had successful pregnancies. This study doesn't argue with that. This study says that maybe if they were on that, they may be at higher risk for adverse pregnancy outcomes, which could be, you know, small for a gestational age, birth weight, preeclampsia, eclampsia, premature delivery, etc. Okay. Speaking of pregnancy and lupus, there was this publication this week that showed in a study of 158 patients with RA who became pregnant, half of them were on TNF inhibitors during pregnancy. And those that were on TNF inhibitors versus those that were not, there were differences in some of the outcomes. The main one being, if they were on TNF inhibitors, the offspring had higher birth weights compared to those who were not on TNF inhibitors. And that, to me, that makes sense, because if you're on TNF inhibitor, you're controlling inflammation. Control of inflammation means a healthier baby and more of a normal weight. Whereas inflammation, which could run amok in people not on TNF inhibitors, not being treated with biologics during the pregnancy, inflammation could actually have detrimental effects, including lower birth weight offspring. In this study, they looked at biomarkers of placental health. This includes placental growth factor and soluble FMS like tyrosine kinase 1. These go up during pregnancy, and there's a ratio there that tells you about pregnancy health. Bottom line is, they showed that while those changed during pregnancy, they were not influential in the outcomes. And what was influential in the outcomes was the use or non-use of a TNF inhibitor, and with being on a TNF inhibitor during pregnancy led to healthier outcomes. You may have seen the publication this week where we just listed for you 13 factors associated with RA patients who get interstitial lung disease. This is a meta-analysis of 56 studies involving almost 12,000 patients. Overall, they found that the pooled prevalence rate of RA-ILD was 18.7%. And you should know and probably can guess the 13 factors. And I'll just rattle them off. These are all significant, it looks like. Actually, one's not significant that I look at it now. And that looks like older age at RA onset. But being male, older age, smoking history, pulmonary comorbidities, longer RA duration, positive serologies, higher SED rates, higher DAS scores, rheumatoid nodules, leflunomide use, and steroid use. Now, do you really think that leflunomide, the steroids, cause more ILD, or are they in play in people who have worse RA, and it's sort of a carry-along casual association? Interestingly, in this study, if patients were on biologic agents, that was found to be protective, with a significantly lower, 23% lower risk of developing RA-ILD. You may have seen the tweet that I put up this week from Jeff Sparks' group at ACR 23, abstract 1269, which was the 3S rule. RA patients who have the 3Ss have a, 13-fold higher risk of developing RA-UIP, usual interstitial pneumonitis, the most common form of ILD in RA. What are the 3Ss? 1, sex, being male. 2, smoking. 3, seropositivity. RA patients with the 3Ss have a significantly higher risk of developing RA-UIP. And again, that comes from the Brigham group. We've got one more report and then a case. Mortality in psoriatic arthritis. The Swedish study, using all their outpatient clinics and their registry data that involves over 33,000 cases, found that PSA patients have an 11% increase in all-cause mortality compared to age sex match controls. All age groups had an increased risk of mortality except for those under age 40, and the highest estimates for mortality was in the 40 to 59-year-old group, and it was probably more prevalent in women, where the risk is a 23% higher risk, and those who have longer disease duration, where the risk is an 18% increased risk. So what the interesting factor in here was that all that risk, that 11% overall risk, was related to comorbidity. So that when they Adjusted for comorbidity, the elevated mortality risk disappeared. And you do know that PSA patients have a higher degree of comorbidity, which is another big plea for us to be actively managing, identifying and managing the comorbidities in patients with inflammatory arthritis, especially psoriatic arthritis. I'm going to end with a case from Polly Sepulvedo, who's in Oregon, and she writes me in an Ask Kush Anything case, a 70-year-old female who has a painful rash over lower extremities for 10 years. The biopsies were consistent with lupus. The serologies were consistent with lupus, with a positive ANA, SSA, SSB, leukopenia, and fatigue at onset. All other labs were normal. She had been treated with hydroxychloroquine for 10 years. The patient didn't tolerate azathioprine or methotrexate. The patient doesn't want to keep getting skin biopsies. She sent me a picture of these sort of horrific plaque-like lesions on the legs. Erythematous, not discoid-like, but you know, large circular plaques and whatnot. She didn't send me pictures of classic lupus erythematous acute LE rashes like you'd see on the face or on the fingers or the hands. And so she wanted to know, how would I manage this? And my answer to her was, I'm in Dallas and I have a handful, like four or five really good lupus dermatologists, medical dermatologists who have expert experience in managing these cases. I'd want that patient to be seen by my expert dermatologist, or I take pictures and send it to my expert dermatologist. But basically, this is a case of chronic LE, chronic cutaneous LE, right? Could it be discoid lupus? Could it be SCLE? Could it be drug-induced lupus? I mean, this is a 70-year-old with 10-year history of refractory skin diseases and positive serologies, but not the other things that you'd like to see. She may not even meet criteria for systemic lupus erythematosus. So after getting one of my dermatologists to see it, I really want to know the answer to the question is, could this be a drug-induced cutaneous LE rash? You know, the SCLE rashes now, or a lot of them, are induced by chronic PPI use. And so the risk now, the drugs that cause chronic cutaneous LE is PPIs, TNF inhibitors, fexofenadine, levothyroxine, metoclopramide, metronidazole, terbinafine, statins, and hydroxyurea. There's also other drugs that cause ANCA-associated cutaneous vasculitis, and that would include hydralazine, PTU, penicillamine, minocycline, all those sort of things. So that's how I would manage it. The question is, what drugs would you use to manage this? Belimumab actually has been shown to work in cutaneous LE. Other reports that are out there, anifrolumab works very well in cutaneous LE, as does the JAK inhibitors. And I don't know the question as to what hydroxychloroquine did in managing him, but I think I now give you and Dr. Sepulveda a number of options for you to consider in managing a case like this. This month, you're going to be seeing replays from Room Now Live, which occurred at the end of January in 2024. This past week, we've replayed a lot of RA content. Next week, it's all psoriatic arthritis content. You'll get an invite to participate in the Tuesday night rheumatology webinar. It's going to be at 6:30 on Tuesday the 9th, I believe it is, of April. And in the subsequent weeks, we're going to have sessions and weeks devoted to other topics like vasculitis, spondyloarthritis, and, yes, SLE. So look for the content. Attend the webinars. I think you'll find these interesting. Tune in. We'll do more next week.